Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm not sure I can think of another piece of music that makes me smile more than that wonderful song, Going Home, by the great Jonathan Butler. And Jonathan Butler, I am thrilled to say, is the headline act for this year's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival, coming up on Saturday, August 17th in Celebration Place, right on Kenosha's Harbor, in support of the Mahone Fund. And I am thrilled to have Jonathan Butler joining me over the telephone to talk for a few minutes about his marvelous life and his career and what we can come to expect from him joining us for the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. Jonathan Butler, we welcome you to the morning show.
My brother, thank you so much for having me on your show. And you definitely started my day with, like, one of my favorite all-time songs that, you know, listening to it, it was recorded many years ago, but it sounds like it was recorded yesterday. It's like I can hear the bass, I can hear the organ, the percussion. It's so amazing. Just to listen to the sound, even though I'm listening over the radio, it's, and you know, I'm going to just be prepared. I'm going to take people to South Africa when I get there.
Well, I know people are excited about this. I have to say, the Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival has brought in some really big names over the years, but there is, yes, a very special excitement attached to your upcoming performance as far as a whole lot of people are concerned. So we're really thrilled to have you.
I'm very, you know, very humbled, and I'm grateful. You know, it's I always tell people, you know, and remind people, this is a little boy that came from South Africa, from a shanty upbringing, from a poverty upbringing, one of 13 children, and I had no idea, you know, God's plans was to bring me thus far and put me in front of an audience in America. I mean, it's a dream. It's still a dream to me. You know, I was never really ambitious as a child because, you know, growing up poor, you're always worried about eating the next day. You're always worried about what you're going to wear. There was never, you know, there was never enough, and especially no electricity, no running water. And so I really, you know, have to sometimes just remind myself that God has brought me an incredibly long way. And so I'm just grateful to hear my music on the airways, you know, in America. I mean, most children I know that grew up like I do, this is what I do. This is why I feel like I have to be that voice, you know, and help inspire them to do what, you know, to bring that gift of them out and forward, you know.
Very well said.
I know it sounds so much, but it's like, you know, sometimes it's good to remind your even yourself, like, hey, just remember who you are and where you came from and what your story means. And always don't be afraid to tell your story.
Mm. I want to dig into your story just a little bit. And my understanding, I mean, and yes, I certainly knew, and most people know, that you grew up in a very, very poor family in South Africa back in the time when apartheid still had a very rigid hold over the entire population of that country. I have read in your biography that something of a early inspiration for you was the moment when your father presented you with a homemade one-string guitar. I'd love to hear the story of what your dad saw in you that inspired him to make that possible and to present that gift to you.
And, you know, the thing is also, I was the only left-hand child in the house. So it used to be like a paraffin can that used to put gas in the car. So it was like a... So my father was able to actually create a neck with a peg and a gut string. And as a matter of fact, you know, you can now buy these guitars as African souvenirs in South Africa. In South Africa, actually, my daughters, they have one of my guitars that somebody gave me as a gift, because now they sell them as as an iconic piece of South African art. And so for me, it was an incredible moment, because my love for the instrument started with my dad, who was a banjo player, and my grandfather was a banjo player. And from what I've learned and discovered was that my grandfather came from the Americas through Liberia, Monrovia, and my grandfather, being a banjo player, taught my dad, and they founded the Cape Town Carnival Festival, which is where each community will compete for the first prize in the stadium. So my dad and the string of his friends were all banjo players, and that's where my love for the instrument started. And then my older brother, Cecil, was also an incredible banjo player and a guitarist, and my father was also a singer. So, you know, every time that they are not around, I used to pick up the guitar and put it on my lap and just play with one string. And the only string, only song I could, that I learned, was actually Delilah by Tom Jones. So that was the only song that I learned on that guitar. As a matter of fact, I actually loved Tom Jones even to this day, because I actually thought he was a black guy, because he sounded so soulful. Wow. You know, I really thought he was a black guy, because I never really saw him. There was no TV in South Africa until 1975 or 74. Television was introduced to South Africa, and so that's where my love started for the instrument. And I continued to learn how to play backwards, you know, upside down. I had to sort of look at my father's fingers and my brother's chord positions to kind of learn it upside down. So then I became really good at playing upside down, and my older brother was very proud of me, and my dad was very proud of me, because I ended up figuring how to play this thing upside down, you know. and it was sort of, Jimi Hendrix was sort of the next person that I learned growing up played upside down. There aren't many guitar players in the world that I know of. There's a guy called Eric Gale now, who's, I think, is incredible. So what I've learned over the, I taught myself to play upside down and as a left-handed player, you know, changing the strings that it looks like it's right-handed, but it is up, it's still upside down. So, but it really started in my home, where there was a lot of music. There was more music than conversation, because we, that's how we kept ourselves warm. That's how we, you know, stayed together. That's how we kind of helped each other. My parents used to promote concerts to put us on stage at an early age in our lives. So
right.
We were on stage very early.
So in the early part of your life, as you were first really getting serious about music and making music,
was music
in your mind a way out of your poverty, or did you not think of it that way? Did you think of music simply as a gift to enjoy in the moment, in the circumstances in which you and your family were living?
It was a way out. It was a way out. I soon learned as a child, because, you know, I was singing from the age of 5 years old. I was on stage singing in local nightclubs. I was singing in places that was actually not even allowed for kids to play. I did cabaret shows. I sang, adult songs like Delilah and all, like, as a, you know, I got paid. They would pay me, and so that money, the money they would pay me, I would give to my mom, and that money helped my mother feed, you know, us, you know. So my mother's blessing, my father's blessing, was everything that made me understand why it was so important to them and why it became important to me to support my mom and my father, because my father was, he was laid off from work. He was on disability. He was ill. And my mom was the only person that had a permanent job as a hairdresser, which didn't pay a lot of money. So me going out to sing every weekend was a way to give my mother, you know, the money that I earned on stage went always to my mom. And I mean, I'll tell you now, even to this day, at the age of 62, I never really believed the money that I earned over the course of my life was meant for me. It was meant for others.
Wow.
And I've never really had a sense of value or, you know, no, this is mine, you know. I would rather have a guitar and say, that's mine. That used to be the friend that I always had when I was young. That used to be my companion when I was older, and it still is to this day. So I've never really had that kind of feeling of, oh, this is mine. You know, this all belongs to me. So supporting my mother and my father was something that I just that was my motivation. Every time I gave him my wages packet, which was a brown packet, and the amount would be written on top of it, she would say, God bless you, son, you know? And I think that blessing, whenever she said it, it extended so far to where I am sitting talking to you.
Wow,
so,
I love that.
And that's what I tell my children. I bless my children, not for today. I bless them for the rest of their lives, so they know I really mean it. You know, and so I think my mother, in some ways, she imparted something that motivated me always when I sing, when I go on stage, and you know, I'm able to support the people that I love around
me. I know
so,
that
you know.
I know that as a young teen, you won some kind of local talent show that was an important opportunity for you because, if I understand correctly, it allowed you to perform all over South Africa. And if I understand correctly, for very different sorts of audiences, sometimes for in venues where the audience would be, I think, mostly white, and then other times you would be performing for black audiences. What are your most vivid memories of that experience of touring the country and seeing, in a sense, both sides of the divide of apartheid with your own eyes, perhaps in a way you hadn't seen before?
Well, you know, Greg, if I think about when I left my parents that night to, I remember I had performed in all these carnivals and the late choirs as a little boy, and when I did this audition for this English man who was, to me, a giant coming into my parents' home to hear me sing, I remember fleeing the house because I'd never seen a white man before, especially such a big person, but I had to sing for him, because he was the boss, he was the director, he was the guy, you know, and the touring company was called the Golden City Dixies. There were many other plays around South Africa. One was called King Kong. These were different type of plays, and so the play had so many different storytelling components. Some would be in Zulu, some would be in Afrikaans, some would be in English. So you had to learn to sing in different languages, and you had to dress in costume every night. And so it was very disciplined. You had to have clean white shirts. You had to have clean sneakers. You had breath inspections. You had dress rehearsals. You had full rehearsals. And we would stay in people's homes, or the auditorium was our accommodation. So I just wanted to say, like, as a child, I was completely, I had a brother and sister that also was on the play, in the play. But as a young boy, I was very afraid. I was very, it was a scary, it's sometimes scary, because I used to sleep in a room with seven brothers. Now I'm sleeping in the room by myself as a little boy. It was, you know, and they had to turn the lights off, and I never could sleep with the lights. It would just freak me out. So I ended up, going on that tour, and that tour went to, you know, we would tour for almost like a whole year. We would go to Zimbabwe, we would go to Angola, we would go to throughout South Africa, Namibia, and so every week, every weekend I get my paycheck, my envelope, and my brother and I would go to the post office and put our stamps on it and send the money to my parents through telegram. You know, back then it was to use telegrams to send money to people. You know, but it was also very, very exciting for me, because I saw so many different countries. Mm. I saw so many different cities. What most kids who lived sheltered lives, I lived in an adult world where people drank, smoked, cursed. I mean, it was just, you know, I had to learn. It was like I had to grow up very, very, very quickly in that environment.
I should say. For those of you just joining us, those of you just joining us, let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with the renowned jazz musician Jonathan Butler, magnificent singer, songwriter, and guitarist, and the headliner for the 2024 Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival coming up this Saturday at Kenosha Celebration Place. Mr. Butler, at the age of 13, you were noticed by a very important British record producer, Clive Calder.
Yes.
And not long after that, he signed you to Jive Records, and the rest is history from that point on. What do you remember him telling you in terms of what he saw in you? What was he so impressed with that made him want to take you under his wing and, in a sense, share your remarkable music with the rest of the world?
Well, you know, I'd become a household name in South Africa, playing in different settings and shows and touring, and of course they already had artists that I was listening to on the radio, and that was like such a thing for me to hear people singing on the radio. And I always thought, man, I always like wished that I would be on the radio, you know, because it was, we had a gramophone in the house. My father, we didn't have electricity, but we had this gramophone that we had a battery that, you know, so you could tune into radio and hear it. And so when Clive Calder signed me, it was this gentleman who passed away. His name was David Bestman. He was an MC guy for all these concerts. And he was very close for Clive. He's also one of the people that worked for Clive Calder. And he told Clive about me, you know. And Clive came to see me performing at a R&B club, actually, with a really good band. And they were like the Jackson 5 back then. And I was like little Michael Jackson. So Clive was absolutely impressed with my, I guess, the fact that I could sing in English the way I did. And I could tell, you know, I could communicate with people. that he came to see my mother the next day, and he asked to sign me, you know, right there on the spot. And so I was signed to Clive for almost, I was a little kid till I was 21, you know. And my first record that they recorded, that I recorded on for Clive Calder Productions, went to number two on the pop radio in South Africa. It went to the number two spot, and you know, lo and behold, I become the first young black artist to be played on white radio stations and across the country. And suddenly I'm like as famous as Michael Jackson. I can't walk around. I can't sit down. And the fans, screaming fans. And so, you know, I often think about Clive and how much he played a role in me being here where I am.
Right.
He always said to me, Jonathan, always remember, there's only one Stevie Wonder and there's only one Jonathan Butler. And you need to find your own voice. Mm. Always try to find your own voice. And so that's really stuck with me over the course of my life. And I realized what he said and what he had done for me, given me the opportunity to live this dream. Because when I remember hearing myself on the radio, my whole family was just like, you know, I'm like, forget Tom Jones. I'm on the radio now.
Absolutely. Let's listen to just a little bit of what I believe is your first big hit, and this is the song called Lies. And is this from that very first album?
That's actually the second album, but that was a big hit for me.
Right.
Big crossover record.
Yes, let's just hear just a little bit of this. This is Lies featuring Jonathan Butler. And by the way, a little later in the program, once I've let you go from our interview, I'm going to play each of these songs that I've excerpted in their entirety so people can enjoy them. I want to ask you about this experience of you being the first black artist to be played by white radio stations all over South Africa. My question is, why do you think it was you? I mean, there had obviously been other talented black artists in South Africa, but you are the one who managed that breakthrough onto white radio stations. Do you think there was something about you and your personality or about you and your music that somehow made it maybe more approachable, more accessible for white audiences? Or what do you think that made you the first artist?
That's a good question. And I'll answer it this way. I always tell young artists and up-and-coming artists, you know, managers and record labels, back then, Clive Calder had a vision. They weren't just a record company, but they had vision for what they wanted to accomplish with me. They had a vision that they could hear that I was not just a one-dimensional artist, but I was able to cross over into other parts of, you know, other genres in the music industry. So them being visionary, being the visionaries that they were, I mean, you know, I also had a manager who was able to clothe me, you know, I mean, I was wearing, you know, amazing clothes from different companies. So they took me on as an entire project to help, I'd like to use the word the right way, shape me as an artist for the future. So their thing was long-term vision of me crossing over. And at some point in the relationship, they also managed to realize that as a young South African, black South African, I also had a message and a story to tell. So that's when, you know, I sort of started developing, playing more instrumentals in some areas. So I think I credit it to them for being the visionaries that they were, because as a young artist, all I wanted to do was to be on radio. I had no idea. I mean, the way I sang, my pronunciations, you know, even when I listened to Lies, people thought that I was from America, the way I was singing, you know, even in South Africa, they thought, is this kid from, you know, is he from America, you know? but the truth is, it's everything. I went to I took choreography lessons. I went to, you know, I had to learn how to read. I mean, when they signed me, I was a kid that couldn't even read properly, you know. So my manager made sure that I was able to read and do proper interviews. And so those were the times when record companies and A&R people were really focused on shaping the artists for the future. So, and I think a lot of that is kind of missing in some ways today, because, I mean, those were really, you know, I mean, I woke up in the morning, I had to go to, you know, I had to do my whatever I had to do to learn, and then I had to go to do choreography lessons, rehearsals, and then I had to also start learning how to write songs. And so I think I credit it to Clive and to Ralph Simon, who managed me at the time, who saw that I was definitely not one-dimensional, that I was able to cross over into other genres, you know. Mm-hmm. That's why Lies became such a big crossover hit in London and in the U.S., you know.
Where it was nominated for a Grammy Award.
Yeah, that song and Going Home on the same album was not two Grammy nominations for the same, for, you know, as an instrumentalist and as a vocalist. So, I mean, they accomplished that in a way that actually I'm now actually thinking, wow, that's pretty impressive.
Right.
You know, that they had this vision that, no, he can also play guitar, so let him scat, let him do that. And until I met George Benson, I said, man, you know, you're the only one that inspired me, because when I heard George Benson, I was like, oh, my word, you're somebody that just, he doesn't just sing, but he's able to scat and sing. I was like, that just like, you know, made me complete. I was like, complete. Yeah.
I want to be sure to ask you about something that not very many people can say. And that is that your music was a very direct inspiration and source of encouragement for none other than Nelson Mandela during his imprisonment. I just wonder what it's like for you to have heard those words and to know that your music has made such a difference, not only in the lives of all kinds of ordinary people, but that it was something important to Nelson Mandela during the last years of his imprisonment.
Well, you know, I, like I said earlier, you know, I am so humbled and I'm so really grateful, because as a child, I've never heard his name spoken in our home and in circles or social places where I went, because it was, you know, the political ramifications that would happen if you get caught talking about politics in the apartheid. And but over the course of my life, I you know, for the last 12 years, I've been taking 40 Americans to South Africa on my safari, which I host. I've been hosting for 12 years, and I'm going back again in October to host my safari. And I take people into his prison cell. I take people into the garden where he wrote his book and where he hid his book. And I had no idea that one day I would actually just meet him face-to-face in the presidential state house with Prince Charles and Prince Henry and Prince William. And I'm standing there looking, you know, around me and gazing at him, and I'm in just complete awe. And, you know, the story was that he appreciated my music. He discussed it. They used to debate George Benson, Jonathan Butler, Earl Clue, because they used to get an hour radio time in prison, you know, and they would debate. And I was honored that he would say that, because the last time I saw him, I sang at his birthday. He turned 94. He had just turned 94. And I was sitting, he was sitting next to Sharon Stone, Robert De Niro, and Clint Eastwood, and all these, oh my God, it was just a plethora of, a buffet of all the big Hollywood people in South Africa. And I remember that Saturday very clearly, because my mother died, and I went to say goodbye to my mother, and then went to the hotel to sing happy birthday to Mandela. I mean, I was standing right in front of him, you know, and it was really an incredible honor to have stood in his, to be in his company, because I often say, you know, it's amazing what God has done and how I met Desmond Tutu the same way. I mean, talk about a light in the world. These guys were, they were pillars of righteousness. They were pillars of light in our country and around the world. And I carry that with me all the time. Mm. I always do.
Yeah. Very good. Very well said. We're speaking with Jonathan Butler on today's morning show. Mr. Butler, do you have time for two more quick questions?
Sure, absolutely. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. I want to touch on another recording of yours that I came across very recently, which kind of talks about is an example of maybe a slightly different kind of music making. I believe you have done, among other things, a beautiful cover of Fire and Rain by James Taylor.
Yeah, that record came out under Rendezvous Records. That was a beautiful experience, because you know, I'm just going to tell you, I am a huge Stevie Wonder. He's like a mentor, friend, brother to me. The next one is definitely James Taylor, because I have loved James Taylor since I was a boy. Carole King, Tapestry, the LP Tapestry. And I think James Taylor is a complete artist, musician, you know, just a complete human. He's just a complete guy. I mean, his guitar playing and singing is like, they should talk more about his guitar playing, because he's freaking phenomenal on guitar. He is amazing.
I agree with you. I think you're making a very good point about him, and sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle of his lovely songwriting and lovely singing. I want to play just a little bit. I want to play just a little bit of your cover of Fire and Rain, and then I want to ask you about what it's like when you pick up someone else's song, in a sense, and want to make it your own. But let me just play a little bit of your performance. Again, this is of James Taylor's song, Fire and Rain.
Yes.
Yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Susan, the plans they made put an end to you. So I woke up this morning and I wrote down the song. Can't remember who to send it to yet. And I've seen fire and ice and rain. Since sunny days I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times that I couldn't find a friend. But I always thought I'd see your face again.
As much as I adore James Taylor's original recording of that and all the other recordings he's made, I have to say, I love that every bit as much. I just love what you do with that song. I'm curious to know,
what
does it feel like when you are not singing a song of your own, but singing a song by somebody else, and wanting to bring something fresh and new and personal to it while remaining true to that song's sort of origins. What kind of a challenge is that, and what kind of a satisfaction do you get from this particular sort of musical venture?
You know, you can channel, as long as you can channel your own spirit, you know, as long as you allow your own spirit to guide you, you will not sound like the original. You'll be yourself. You know, I'm sure if I sing it tomorrow, or later tonight for myself, I will probably channel even more of that ancestral South African energy to bring it to it. Because if somebody's covering my song, I want them to take it to a whole nother level, because it makes me, I just wanted to pay tribute to him, because I think to James Taylor, because I think he's one of those artists that I'm going to tell you a really funny, this is really crazy, a true story. So I moved to LA back this 30 years ago now, maybe 25, 30 years ago. I moved to LA and I'm staying with a friend of mine. Actually, he used to be my first manager that we were discussing earlier. So I'm staying with him in Brentwood, you know, and so his wife is a lawyer. So Emily, so I'm staying there for a couple of days. I'm looking for a house in Los Angeles to bring my family over. And I wake up Saturday morning and I sit by the piano and I'm playing, you know, I think I was playing Fire and Rain. I was playing something on the piano. He had a beautiful Steinway and I was sitting there playing. And a lady comes into the space where I'm sitting. So she sits next to me and I'm playing and she's crying. Suddenly she's crying. And I look and it's Carol, you know, Carol King.
Whoa.
You know, and Carol King is sitting next to me and I'm like, you know, tripping out. I'm like, oh my God, I love you. I love you. I love way over yonder, the place that I know, and I will find shelter from the rain and the cold. I started thinking about all these songs. And she turns around. She said, "You know, I think she was not playing anymore for a while, but suddenly something inspired her, and we talked for a minute. I just want to pay tribute to these people that have, you know, helped shape and helped me listen and helped me with my artistry, helped me with my songwriting, helped me with melody, James Taylor is one of the most amazing guitarists." That nobody talks about. And I'm telling you, it's just, and that's the way I approach sort of my guitar playing. I don't think, you know, a lot of times when I sit and play or play on stage, I play the chords that help my voice so there's a marriage, so that it's a perfect marriage every time when I'm playing my guitar and I'm singing together with it. That is a perfect marriage. From like Stevie Wonder and the harmonica and these Fender Rhodes, it's just can't separate. And that thing with James Taylor, you cannot separate his voice from his guitar and vice versa. I think he's just a complete great, you know. So
that is so true. I think you've put that very, very well. You have been doing this for quite some time and doing so very, very well. You and I are roughly the same age. I'm 64. I think you're a couple years younger than I am, but you and I are both at a point in our lives when I'm a singer and a piano player, and both of those things, although they're still really fun, sometimes feel a little different than they did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Certain things maybe are easier now, and a whole lot of things are maybe a little harder now. I wonder, in general, what does your music making feel like at this point in your life? What does it feel like physically, and what does it also feel like emotionally and spiritually for you? Does your music making represent maybe something a little different in your life than it once did?
That's a good question, because I feel like my music, it's like, you know, it's like a well, you know, that always, if it's not overflowing, then I'm living to help cultivate that. I've got to make sure that I keep the well full, you know. And a lot of people come, I think I like it better where Celine Dion said something so beautiful. I wish I can remember how she said it. But she was saying that she was like an apple tree, you know, and people would come and pick the apples. The branches were heavy, people would come and pick the apples. But when there's no more, when the branches are no longer heavy with apples, she doesn't want to be a branch that is not fruitful. I think the way that she said it was so amazing. Let me quote it this way. I think Psalm 1 said it best, you know, blessed is the man whose tree is planted by the water, you know. He will yield his fruit in season. So I think as I get older, my fruit will mature, the branches, the trunk will mature. I am maturing. I want to make more spiritual music. I want to make music that really touches my heart, that calls me and affects me. And makes me want to go to that well, whether it's in a prayerful state. I just wrote a song a couple of days ago that I cannot stop playing because it's almost like an ancestral cry for water, for thirst. Like, I'm thirsty, God. I need to be filled. But I gave the song a name. I called it Song for Marcus. Because, you know, but even though I'm saying this is a song from a friend, I kind of also hear the underlining. I feel the underlining calling for me to be more in that ancestral spiritual place. That's where I feel my greatest strength lies when I'm tapping into my roots from Africa. When I'm tapping in deeply into my roots. You know, when I start writing, I don't listen to radio. I don't listen to, you know, hip-hop, R&B. I just listen to what is inside of me. And once I sit down and just allow that roots and the ancestral calling to happen, I never used to be that way when I was younger because I always wanted to be, you know, in the trends and find my way in the trends and, you know. But I'm not so much now. Now I feel like maybe my branches are, you know, maybe the roots are spreading a little bit more towards my homeland and beyond my homeland. And I think I need to, people need more, you know. I mean, you know, I appreciate all the genres that are out there, smooth jazz, you know. But I also hear a lot of the similar, you know, I hear a lot of similar styles, you know, and I feel like maybe that's not for me anymore. Maybe I just need to stay true to what is inside and follow that, you know, that let that be my guide for my future music. And maybe it won't be, you know, trendy to the young, you know, but to the young ear. But to me, it's about making a statement. That you can feel the vibration. What I'm trying to do, you can feel my vibration.
Sure,
I know.
Like that...
Going home when you played Going Home. When you played Going Home, I mean, that was for me. It's almost like that's a vibration that I felt when I left my country. I was still saying it to everybody. Hey, I'm going home. You know. And this is now, I was saying it then, and I'm still saying it now. You know,
yes.
What I mean?
Well, I was going to say, I know, if not your most recent album, one of your most recent albums is called Ubuntu. And
Ubuntu, yes.
Yes, and that appears to be a recording that is, as much as anything, calls you back to your own African roots in a really powerful and
yes.
beautiful way.
Yes. Yes, yes, and it's like I was on safari when I actually approached Marcus Miller, who joined me on my safari. I approached him to produce the record, and we spent some time in Johannesburg, and we recorded the album in 3 days, and it just unlocked something inside of me. You know, mm-hmm. It just unlocked. And shaping the album the way it did made me feel like, okay, you know, you don't, you, you know, that you're in a good space musically. You're in a good place musically, and don't ever ignore these little melodies that you play to yourself in the house. Mm-hmm. You know, the minute you hear it, record it. And that's exactly what I try to encourage young people. Don't ever throw your four-bar ideas away. Always record it. Mm. You know, always keep your phone ready. I woke up this morning with an idea. It was like 4 a.m. in the morning, and I woke up with an idea, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this must be something, you know, that I'm writing. And, you know, and it's called Fill the Air Tonight, you know. Fill the air with your bright, righteous light. You know, I mean, this is 4 a.m. in the morning. I'm hearing these things in my head, and I'm just, you know, and I'm like, let thy word heal this broken heart.
Mm. So the ideas are still coming. They're still flowing. And that's, of course, the most exciting thing for the life of a musician. And your music, of course, is continuing to make a difference in so many lives. And I can't tell you how many people are so excited that you are coming to Kenosha for this upcoming Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival. You are the headliner, performing Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. in Celebration Place. To finish out, I'm going to play a little bit from your album Ubuntu. But first, because we've already taken more of your time, I want to let you go. But with my sincere thanks for being part of the morning show today, I was so honored to speak with you and wish you safe travels to Kenosha and continued happy music making in the years to come.
Thank you, my brother. Thank you, man. I'm going to tell everybody I'm looking forward to being in Kenosha.
Africa.
Jonathan Butler, an excerpt from his recent recording, Ubuntu. He is the headliner for this year's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival this Saturday, August 17th at Kenosha's Celebration Place. The entire event benefits the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund. And you can go to mahonefund.org for more information on all that will be taking place Saturday afternoon and into the evening. My thanks to Jonathan Butler for taking time to be my morning show guest today here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we talk about another facet of this weekend's Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival, the cooking studio. I'll talk with Terry Jacobson, who is cooking studio captain when she's not busy being Kenosha County Treasurer. And we're talking with two superb chefs associated with Bartolotta Restaurants in Milwaukee, Aaron Bickham, who is corporate executive chef, and Connor McNeil, executive chef at Joey Gerard's, a Bartolotta supper club in Greendale. McNeil is going to be the special guest chef for this year's cooking studio. And Tim Mahone himself is along for part of this interview as well. And on Friday, a memorable conversation with the author of a new book called The Boys of Riverside, A Deaf Football Field, Football Team, and A Quest for Glory. Our weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies today and a high of 83 degrees, but clouds will roll in, and we have a 60% chance of rain developing after midnight with a low of 66. Tomorrow, a very rainy day. Showers and thunderstorms. Some could very well contain heavy rains. Tomorrow's high 79 degrees. A lingering chance of rain both Friday and Saturday, right around 40%. By Sunday, sunshine should return, and we should have sunshine and comfortable temperatures into the middle of next week. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.